Welcome to Spiritually Naked, where physical and non-physical worlds collide, offering a refreshing concoction of optimism and realism. It's time to strip down the barriers of limiting beliefs, to master the art of manifestation and synchronized living. Everything you need to live an inspired, awakened life is within your grasp. Start creating the life you desire today with Spiritually Naked as your guide to simplifying complicated issues for real life change. Now here are your hosts, Steve and Stephanie Banks.
Hello everyone, and thank you for joining us here today on Spiritually Naked. I'm your host, Stephen Banks, and I'm here with my partner and co-host, Stephanie Banks, who in the second portion of our program will channel for us a collective consciousness named Solomon. We're very excited for today's show. As our guest, we have David Lowe, who is a professor of religious studies for 10 years. He worked as a drug counselor, taught meditation, and does dream work. David has recently published his first book, Universal Spiritual Philosophy and Practice. David, thank you for being here with us today. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Steve. I really look forward to it.
So, Universal Spiritual Philosophy and Practice. That is...
pretty loaded.
That is pretty loaded.
Unload that one for us.
Yeah, it basically clearly sets forth the underlying commonalities of all religion and spiritual practice around the globe in a fun, interesting, short way. That's what makes it unique. 48 pictures, word balloons, 200 pages. It's got everything in there. It tries to be encyclopedic, but in a brief way. That's kind of what it's about.
So you're basically giving definitions of ideas around spiritual philosophy?
Well, it gives you different levels of understanding of common questions, like what is the devil, right? There's a simple, easy answer, and there's a complex, profound answer. The book gives you both, so you can kind of find your own level and a type of understanding. That's kind of what it does. It summarizes thousands of people's similar experiences in different environments, in different spiritual environments, rather than any one person's experience.
Cool. So sort of removing that idea of confining everything to a specific sector, specific box or
right,
title.
Right. And I mean, it is often difficult reading, but the pictures and the word balloons and the graphics make it easier.
I think
it's compelling. People have told me I get a lot out of reading the same section for the second time, third time.
Yeah, that's
so I must have done something right.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's when you know there's something to be taken on different levels, right? And so you brought it up. So from your perspective and in your book, what is the devil?
Oh.
The devil is, on the surface, of course, he's just this red creature with...
You mean that's not really the devil?
Yeah, with a pitchfork and a forked tail. The devil is obviously just a conveniently vast oversimplification for all the hassles, difficulties, and evils on Earth. Just this vast oversimplification, this concept is sort of condensed into this red creature, you know. But anyone who really stops to think realizes that those issues are just inherent in reality. It's like Buddha's first noble truth. Life is intimately characterized by suffering. You know, all pleasures eventually turn to suffering or to at least mild disillusionment. So, yeah. I mean, there's obviously great joy and bliss and love in life, but getting there, getting to the core of that joy, bliss, and love involves a lot of disillusionment and occasional heavy-duty suffering. So that suffering is what is condensed into this nonsense concept of the devil.
Right.
You know, but obviously there's no such thing as a devil. It is a useful mythical idea for children, but that's it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's if you want them to grow up in fear. So really the devil is just our own inner scapegoat.
Right. Exactly.
Well, I think it's also the way sometimes life plays out. It's just part of, you know, it's funny though. That's kind of how I think about religion. That it's all just sort of mythical, and you know, there's, I'm sure, some truths to it. Like I now for the first time in my life now believe that there probably was this man named Jesus Christ that actually walked the earth and was, you know, a prophet,
right,
and this and that. But everything else seems to be, to me, a big myth.
Well, no, here's a really, really interesting thing. Everybody is born with what you could call a core idealism, a place where you know, we can go to feel our own level of love, bliss, and joy in moments of suffering. I mean, the mafia enforcer, you know, the narco guy also has on his own level that inner core of idealism, which he can retreat to. Now, we associate that with different things as we grow up. Most of us associate it with religion. But some people associate it primarily with friends and family, or with philosophy and literature, or with drugs. So a lot of people, religion is found amongst friends and family, because that's what they associate that core idealism with. So there are other spiritualities aside from religious spirituality. See what I mean?
Yeah, and it's funny, I sort of just got stuck there in my own brain thinking, I just had this weird light bulb go off that religion is kind of a drug for people. It's an escape.
Well, yeah, I mean, they are these vast gathering points for people of roughly similar spiritual dispositions. But they're just cultural systems. You can measure and observe them. There's nothing deeper. You know, religion is it's a useful, important thing on the surface. I do think overall, it's done more harm than it's done more good than harm, but not by much.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, that'd be a toss-up, I guess.
The reason I wrote the book is I have a burning desire to get people to fathom the deeper dimensions of their religions. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, all the differences vanish. People would realize that the superficial differences in history, geography, ethnicity mean nothing, mm-hmm. nothing of any substance. So like a Jewish example would be, and this is only for, you know, the fundamentalists, not most Jews today. Like the Third Temple of Solomon absolutely has to be built on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and that only Jews can go there. A Muslim example, again, only for the real conservative Muslims, would be that, and in the same place on the Temple Mount should be reserved only for Muslims, because that's where Muhammad had his big meeting with Jesus and so forth. Those are superficial notions upon which, you know, people fight wars over them. Mm-hmm. Blindingly stupid and immature behavior. We need to learn to share. Yeah, my own attachment, I have a problem. I tend to think that fundamentalists who only believe things literally are like spiritual 10-year-olds. So I need to embrace them, which I'm having trouble with.
Solomon could probably help you there.
Yes.
Well, and it's funny because you say that, and yet that's something that you're obviously writing about to a certain degree and advocating for, and I struggle with the same kind of thing sometimes, that the things that I'm really, you know, promoting are sometimes the things that I struggle with the most.
Yeah. Well, the idea of enlightenment, for example, you know, my own view is that, you know, there are people, I think, who are awake in the circles I travel in. It's called being awake or waking up. These are folks who have had, they have had a powerful transformative experience, which blew away all of their other experiences throughout their life as like a 30 or 40 year seeker. So they are spiritually cooked, done completely. So they continue to grow and change as human beings, but spiritually they're like completely cooked. So my view is that, the enlightened John Doe and the enlightened Jesus Christ are virtually the same, except for Jesus having the more important, external karma, shall we say. But otherwise, it's the same unconditional love, the same experience of God, the same embracing union with all reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
So, yeah, it's out there.
Out there, what do you mean?
Well, there's a tendency to, scholars have this idea that, you know, people, scholars say that there's the one common way that people have of thinking is, it's called the golden age theory in academia. A tendency to think that long ago, things were somehow, the laws of physics and chemistry were different, right? The laws of psychology were different. So there are all kinds of miracles and wonderful things happened then, which don't happen now. All the great sages lived then who don't live now. That is nonsense. So we have a tendency to think that ancient things are powerful, special, and
right.
and wonderful,
right.
which they aren't.
Yeah.
There's just as much joy and love and enlightenment in reality now, if not more, as there was back then.
Right. Well,
I think anyway.
And well, when you go really deep into the whole idea of existence, from what I know, there is no such thing as actually the past and the present. It's all happening simultaneously as well. So under that construct, that would imply
right.
that there is no difference in equality. One was one that's actually happening now at the same time as everything else.
Yeah, it's all just a perception of it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, people are really conditioned by their cultures. Academics, especially in the social sciences, are pretty hopeless in that regard. we have this postmodern worldview, which tells us all that there are no underlying deeper realities between cultures, which connect us all, which is nonsense. Anyone who achieves deeper states of meditation and so forth begins to realize through experience that there are underlying things which do connect all human beings.
Well, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. There's a chapter in our book, We Are All One, and it sounds so simple, but it's very profound at the same time. We are all one. So if you acknowledge that, become aware of it, acknowledge it, and then start living in that way, all of a sudden your life just becomes so much more.
We see it everywhere.
And there are underlying similarities between the religions all over the place. I'll give you an example. Between polytheism and monotheism. On the surface, Hinduism is like a very polytheistic faith, right? There are hundreds of deities in that tradition, 15 or 20 major ones. But any educated Hindu knows it all comes out of one big heavyweight. All those deities are just aspect of one huge, profound and all-embracing cosmic principle. That's the monotheistic or monistic aspect of Hinduism. Now, Catholicism, on the surface, is supposed to be monotheistic. But what are people what are their private devotions actually going towards? It's not always God or Jesus. It can be the patron saints, the Beata, right? Or sometimes the Pope, the guy who hasn't been canonized yet. So there's all kinds of polytheism in Catholicism, as well as monotheism in Hinduism, right? I mean, we need sights and sounds and smells and tastes to relate to divinity. It can't just be this thing in our heads, you know. So that's why there is inherent human polytheism, which is just as sincere in Catholics as it is in Hindus. You know, so there are these deeper underlying things, which are the same for all the different religions.
Well,
I mean to bend y'all's ears here.
I understand what you're talking about conceptually. I'm not well versed in all the different kinds of religion
and the definitions,
but I know exactly what you're talking about in terms of when you boil it all down. The principles are there. The fundamental principles are the same. It's about love and compassion and acceptance and
personal power,
personal empowerment, mm-hmm. Connection.
Yeah. Another thing to really understand, which again relates to this golden age fallacy business. Orthodox religion has always used spectacular stories to get people interested. A dead person comes back to life, a leprosy vanishes before your eyes, that kind of thing.
Right.
It's spectacular, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it would make the tabloids. What's not spectacular is the way that miracles usually happen. Like, say, you visit a renowned spiritual master, maybe a Hindu guru or something. You give him a donation, have a good experience there. That night, then you go home. He shows up in your dreams that night, does some hands-on healing. And 2 weeks later, your third stage cancer's gone, mm-hmm. you know. That kind of thing happens around contemporary spiritual masters all the time, but it doesn't make the National Enquirer, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Y'all there?
Yes. Well, the reason why is because it's positive.
Right. Well, there are these stories. I mean, Orthodox stories like that have their use for children, but older people should really contemplate, what are these stories? The church fathers had an agenda of creating a religion for the masses. That's basically where all those stories come from. It's generally thought by scholars that, the gospel accounts were significantly embellished for the sake of mass appeal. So I think, the miracles of Christ could have happened like they take place in the Bible, but they probably didn't. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean that it's any less marvelous, but
just embellished.
Miracles.
Just embellished.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, no, don't apologize. Just embellished. But when you think about the history of humanity, we've been storytellers.
Yeah.
And
exaggeration is a large part of that. Yeah. To if you inflate the emotion around it or the idea of your story. People tend to, it's more profound, it's more impactful, but the underlying idea of the story is the same, the seed of it,
Yeah, and I think it's important to realize, there is a whole level of knowledge which is so powerful. Cultures, myths are called the dreams of cultures precisely because they all the things and myths are ideals, are like ideal types of all the things discussed, which means they have a deeper spiritual reality which resonates inside our being. So mythical stories, which have been told for centuries, they literally work into our genes, I think. And it takes a while to see through them and realize that they are only myths. Mm-hmm. But they have great teaching value for young folks. They do.
Well, I think that's the key, right? And then it's about, as you grow older, letting go of the attachment to the actual story and being more focused on maybe the feeling that's associated with it.
The lesson.
The lesson.
And right. And when you really when you begin to experience the same kind of bliss and joy from normal life and from other more rational, ordinary teachings about psychology and so forth, as you did in myths, then you can let go of the myths.
And exactly. And you know what's funny is that one of the things that I really try to stress with people around me, whether it's just my friends, whether it's employees at work, whether it's, you know, through avenues like this, whether it's speaking events, is that it's the simple things in life where you can really start tapping into the synchronized fashion of it all. Like, it doesn't have to be these big extravagant stories that you have and that they're so profound, and they can be, but it can be the little things too, like just things showing up at the exact right moment for you. And those are the kinds of things that start to happen when you live from the principles I think that you're talking about.
Yeah, and two things I think that people can do to really be happy and to improve their spiritual growth more so than anything else within a short space on the interview. One, breathe more deeply. If everyone could just breathe more deeply and slowly, we would have world peace in 2 months.
Right, I agree.
Really?
I agree.
And the other thing is, like, dreams. They are almost as important as food and water. And they represent a faculty through which we can pick up personally relevant information through inner faculties that transcend time and space. Dreams are ignored way too much, and there's so much information on offer to all of us. Everybody dreams every night, and we would all go nuts within 2 or 3 weeks if we're not allowed to dream. That's been known for decades. So they're important, and they obviously have a spiritual dimension. They're offering information all the time, and we just need to be interested. That's the problem. We need to be interested in them.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because last night I woke up this morning, and I must have been dreaming about this guy that I know through Facebook who's traveling right now, and I woke up thinking about him in Ephesus. And I turn on my phone, and sure enough, there's this long-winded message from him about his travels trying to get from Istanbul to Ephesus yesterday and the trauma that went along with it. Mm-hmm. And my dream, and here I was dreaming about him. So I agree. Like, it's a door opening for you to look at something.
Well, yeah, it's just another aspect.
It's so important. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, it's just another aspect of our waking life. It's just from a different perspective. But what I wanted to ask you, because this is becoming very important in my life right now, so it's very synchronistic that this is coming up. So what I'm doing is I'm trying to remember, write down, and analyze my dreams, because it's been through one of my teachers, Martin Camus. He is teaching me how to analyze the dreams and showing me that these patterns, these important patterns, and they're not literal, they're very metaphorical. So,
right.
So for you, what would you suggest to someone who's struggling with the waking memory of it? Do you have some kind of technique in order for someone to learn to wake up with that memory?
That's pretty basic. Well, yeah, I mean, you can get help from folks like me, but through email and so forth. But you really just, if you're just willing to dialogue with them, you get a diary. Say you have a half hour to spend on dreams every day, not more than that. 10 minutes writing them down, 10 minutes trying to figure them out, and 10 minutes expressing your frustrations and questions to them. So you're dialoguing with your dreams back and forth all the time. Get a symbolism dictionary by all means, but realize, of course, that, you know, the symbols are going to be different for different people in different situations.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, be interested and disciplined enough to dialogue with your dreams through a diary on a regular basis. That will get things moving. Mm-hmm. And keep yourself in, like, uncomfortable situations which create internal conflict. That will keep you dreaming, you know.
Oh, interesting. Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, people who don't remember the dream, just go out, look around, see things which bother you in the world. Put yourself in situations where internal conflicts develop inside you, and you will start dreaming again.
Wow.
Because, you know, so yeah, just dialogue with them.
Okay.
Dialogue with them on a regular basis.
Well, that's
and the way that I used to. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Carry on.
Yeah. So to better remember them, I mean, it's difficult to get up in the middle of the night and write them down with your bedmate next to you and so forth. What I do is I'll wake up in the middle of the night with a dream. And if you can just rehearse it in your mind about 6 times over and over again in order to imprint it in your memory before going back to sleep, and you will remember it in more detail the next morning.
That makes
but
sense.
But it takes a long time to write them down. I realize that. So just bullet points if you only have a half hour a day or something.
Right, right. Well, what's interesting about that technique is that that's the technique that Solomon and the other guides give for learning to distinguish between your ego self and your more authentic self, is to create a dialogue with the two, like introduce yourself to each other, basically, which is sort of an odd concept because it's part of yourself, but you sort of separate them at first until you start becoming aware of their tendencies and responses, reactions, all that sort of stuff. So it's kind of the same thing. You're introducing yourself to your dreams and integrating it from a more aware level.
Yeah, and if in connection with meditation, especially folks who have trouble meditating, if you just sit, a couple of spirit teachers have told me, if all you can do is make yourself sit in the same place for 20 minutes, perhaps with a diary, with a dream diary and so forth, then you are making progress. You are unlocking deeper aspects of your being that another person might more successfully do with a mantra for an hour in a dark room or something. So if you can just sit and do a dream diary or read a profound book or something, that can be a valid meditation for a lot of folks.
I agree, and meditation can be so many different things for people. Sometimes, honestly, I think that my best meditation is when I'm on my snowboard on a powder day in the mountains surrounded by trees and moss.
Right. Now, don't get me wrong. I do think that you know, people should aspire to learn sitting meditation and to be able to go inside and in a dark, quiet room. But if you're not there, I mean, you can do like a walking meditation. Okay, so right. Like you take walk at a normal speed, look more or less at the ground in front of you, and correlate your breathing with your steps. Breathe out for 3 steps and breathe in for the next 3 steps. Just do that for like a half hour. If your mind wanders, just come back to those 2 things, stepping and breathing.
So that's the idea of a labyrinth.
Yeah, I built a labyrinth here and used that. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a labyrinth, like you say. Just count your steps with your breath. I like that idea.
Mm-hmm. Right, for a half hour a day, just walking somewhere. I mean, it's boring, but meditation is a battle with boredom. It's a long-term faith endeavor for a lot of folks, but it's worth it in the end.
Totally. And the funny thing is that, like you say, it's boredom. That's how we initially look at it, because we're forcing ourselves to do essentially nothing with our minds. But once we can get there, it's incredibly rewarding, and then you need it. You realize the importance of that within the balance of your life.
We tried to have this discussion with our 13-year-old because he was getting all sort of antsy because we were taking him into the mountains and there was no cell reception, no technology. And, you know, he's an outdoorsy kid too, but he's just like any other 13-year-old, and he doesn't put his phone down unless we have a wrestling match with him and take it away and listen to some Door Slam for a while. And then, you know, but I was talking to him about, it's okay to be bored. You know, if you find that you're bored there, let yourself be bored.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, to I think, in relation to what the planet's going through right now, with our intensified suffering with all these events, there are deep philosophical lessons to be learned from that. You know, we're living in a time of intensified transformation. The biblical concept of Armageddon, this whole thing about a battle at the end of time, that's a children's story. You know, the real Armageddon happens inside us all the time.
Yeah.
The same thing as the Muslim jihad, the inner struggle. we need to analyze our shadows and transform them into knowledge. So, you know, in reacting to these events, a lot of people let themselves be just like fundamentalists. What they think is, you know, God's going to take care of everything and the day of judgment, which is just around the corner. So as a result, I will abdicate all social responsibility.
Right.
I won't participate. I'll let myself be lazy and somnolent and not do anything.
Yeah, well, and that's what a lot of people have a tendency to do, is to always searching for something outside of them, and that's not the ticket.
No, right. That's not the ticket.
And we need to meditate more than ever and participate in local action more than ever. That's going to help things.
I agree.
That's what we can do about all these. Yeah, but that's what we can do about all these things, is to get into our spirituality.
Right. And you know, you can have hit struck a more important chord, I don't think. And we had this conversation with our friend that we just went to stay with, that Steve was mentioning, in the mountains there, and his thing right now is, look, this is the time when more than ever you need a strong spiritual practice. That's what's going to get you through.
Mm-hmm. And a big important thing that's coming through our channeling, and of course it's well known around the world, is to gather in groups. And even you don't necessarily have to be together. The intent alone,
well, even
will
just
be
like
powerful
this.
Enough. But I'm talking about when to do intent meditations on, mm-hmm. you know, peace and love and raising the vibration on anything in particular, anything. Just everyone places their intent on that idea, and it will, in fact, make an impact whether you see it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's important to try to do it in groups, because there is a power in gatherings, I think, which you don't get alone.
No.
But the further you go on the spiritual journey, the less important groups are. So
right.
We need to try to meditate everywhere.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right.
Well, and then now, too, what's interesting is that science is proving all of these concepts, that through meditation, like it's now in black and white, that meditation and prayers for others, and you know, anything that's coming from the heart-based emotion from your heart center is radiating in such a way that even those that have disputed in the past, it's now scientifically there for them to see.
Yeah, and the concept of a phase transition, like Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the guy who started transcendental meditation 30 or 40 years ago in this country, he had the idea. He apparently did some studies, and he got enough people meditating in small communities here and there, where like once a certain percentage of the population in a small city or town was meditating, a certain percentage or more, the crime rate dropped. Mm-hmm. Right, so there is a phase transition. There is a 100th monkey that can be gotten to, and when that happens, all kinds of people enlightenment will grow like wildfire.
Right.
All of a sudden.
Exactly. And for those of you who out there who are listening to this, I highly recommend either joining or starting a group in order to do this. And it is very impactful. But we're out of time, guys, for this portion of our program. David, if you'd like to let our audience know where they can find you and your services and your book, that'd be great.
Yeah, David Lowe, L-O-W, no E, David Lowe, M-S, PhD.com. That's M as in Masters, David Lowe, MSPhD.com. Or email me at David@worldspirituality.com. That's easy to remember. The book is Universal Spiritual Philosophy and Practice. Long, cumbersome title, but go to the website. You can get it. David Lowe, no E, L-O-W, MSPhD.com. Yeah.
Perfect.
That'd be cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, David. And I highly recommend checking it out.
I also do dream work online, so especially that. If you have trouble with, if you're going through a lot of stuff in your life and you're actively dreaming, then you contact me, please.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So.
But everyone out there, stay tuned, and we'll be back with David and Solomon.
It is our pleasure to be here with you in this time, in your space, in your current reality, in your current perspective of existence. It is our pleasure to aid and assist you on your journey as you aid and assist us. This is a mutual effort. This is a mutual collaboration. We come together with an understanding of one another on a level that feels as though true connection is feasible. That it is through connection that we unite. to rejoice in the existence of one another, of ourselves, of the collective, and the existence of the whole, working in conjunction with the individual aspects that create the whole. We thank you for this opportunity to join with you and to move through this experience together, to offer to you any insights that may be of value to you on your journeys, on your quests, on your searching. We invite you to put forth those questions that you feel may be pertinent to your current position.
Okay, I'm going to start with my concern. I kind of want to ask questions which everyone can benefit from getting the answers to, as well as myself. The first one is, Donald Trump's success in politics has taken everyone by surprise and exposed a dark underbelly of the American character. Does his campaign have any collective spiritual meaning that we should be aware of? What can we learn from it?
We would first like to begin by clarifying that it is not necessarily, particularly, simply the American people that is being represented by this, how you would say, dark energy. Coming back to the idea that there is no separation, there really are no borders per se.
Right.
This is a more of a representation of the entire planet. The disruptions and the eruptions that you're noticing, the imbalances, the maneuvering of structures, the collapsing of collaborations that may not be the most beneficial to the human population and beyond.
Sure. Yeah, wow. So, in particular, what attitude should we have towards it? Are there any practices or things that people can do to mollify his influence, perhaps?
As always, we encourage those from an individual level to follow through on the actions and activities that are best suited to their resonance, to their vibration in any particular moment, not to get too fixated or stuck on any one particular action or practice. Yet to move in the direction where one feels as though they are collaborating with what they wish to collaborate for and who and why. In other words, we encourage those of you who wish to, let's say, find a more fulfilling, a more, let's say, rewarding idea of life, regardless of what direction you may take, for really there is no right and wrong, although that is a difficult concept to bear when seeing the actions of others and the influences that those actions have on your fellow human beings. Yet, on a grander scale, there is no right and wrong, per se.
Wow.
So for this particular incident that we're talking about, this idea of it happens to be taking place in America, where there's so much power around that affects the world. As you said, this is more of a collective idea. So is this a manifestation of the collective want, or is it a manifestation of the underlying collective idea that what we need in order to bring forth transformation?
It is a representation of the change that is occurring within the human collective consciousness.
So it's a reflection of the inner battle that we're going through, generally speaking.
Yes, precisely. To the extreme, does it not seem slightly surreal?
It seems a bit something, that's for sure.
Yeah, so it is the idea of illusionment, it is the idea of perception, it is the idea of the, let's say, experience of life on Earth being that is more theatrical in nature than it is actually a personal experience. When we discuss the idea of removing oneself from the vicinity of, let's say, their more conscious awareness, when you remove yourself slightly out of that state, you begin to have the ability and capability to see life, not only yours, but the lives of others, and from a more collective sense, from a broader perspective, from a less personal perspective. understanding right. that the darkness is there collectively with the lightness, and therefore really, in a sense, should be regarded in the same equal state, because one is there representing the other. Does this make sense?
Yes, it does. In a broad philosophical way, it certainly does. Those are general principles that I think we can all apply. Great. I have another question, which is kind of switching gears. This involves child rearing. A lot of philosophical references in history, like Plato's Republic, an ancient one, a modern one, Neil Donald Walsh's Conversations with God, for example, and other works of philosophy, all advocate that children should be raised by elders. The parents who are in their 20s and 30s can visit them, but that's it. Most of the education and raising should be done by older people with more wisdom and perspective. Could that ever happen, and would it work? Would that make a big difference? And how would we, if so, and then how would we put it into place?
We have a slightly different take on this, although the principle, the idea of being raised collectively is one that we would be more in conjunction with. Yet removing the parental aspect to the degree that some may appeal for is not necessarily in the best interest of a new soul entering into the world. That new soul has specifically chosen those parents for different purposes,
right.
for different reasons that are beyond the grasp of others around them from a conscious level. There
right.
is value in being surrounded by not necessarily just elders, but an array, an assortment of individuals that are bringing forth different ideas, different beliefs, different tools, different techniques, different ways of living, that in a nurturing, caring environment, the idea of acceptance of all of these different ideas, all of these different ways of being are equal to one another and all have value. This is more the idea that we feel is important to understand, less about the
right.
definitions of who is who, but the bond between the parents and the child is explicitly important to maintain. There are multiple cases worldwide. If you look back in your history, most recent and far back in your time, where removing the children from the parents for extended period of times, not allowing that bond to transpire, that really would be more beneficial for both, for all, collectively, not just within the family, but beyond, is more detrimental, specifically
right.
to the child.
Right. I gotcha. Okay. Another question. One theme that we hear from some teachers and from mediums, maybe such as yourself, not all of them, but some, is the notion that life on Earth was seeded, or planted, if you will, by aliens from another planet. Some even say more specifically that we humans are all descended from humanoid creatures who originally came here from somewhere else. Is there any truth to if there is any truth to these notions, should we try to reconnect with them, or if it is true at all? Or do only our souls reincarnate from other places, if not our bodies?
We would like to go back in history a certain degree and bring forth the idea that there are connections far beyond that which you experience on a regular, let's say, normal daily basis as a human being. Although many of you have a connection, a draw to the idea of extraterrestrial beings, let's say, those beyond your perceptual experience, beyond your senses that you're accustomed to being in tune with, in touch with.
Right.
There is a certain curiosity within the human beings as a whole. Now, when we say that, we bring forth the idea that that connection is a result of the, let's say, implementation of your planet by not necessarily simply the human race, but those beyond. There is an interconnectedness throughout the universes, throughout the entire idea of existence, which is limitless. So within that idea, how could there not be connections that are intimate enough to create the idea of a planet?
Right. Right.
In terms of feeling the need to reconnect with, let's say, ancestors, is a very personal experience.
Right.
So just to interject here, but like David had mentioned, there are very specific alien races that are suggested to have come here and, you know, hybridized the human race or planted the seeds. But I mean, is there any real truth to that? I think is a important aspect of the question.
Yes. Read between the lines. We don't necessarily like to lead you to the end of the book. We like you to play along with us and use your imagination, use your intuitive self to guide you in a direction to the story that best seems suited for you. But yes, of course, it's a collaboration, just as this exchange is a collaboration.
Yeah. Okay. I have one more question, which kind of, again, shifts gears. This is about modern technology, iPhones and handheld communication devices. There are two harmful effects thought to be associated with them. The first one is a tendency for some people to become slaves of continual instant gratification, connected mostly with gossip on Facebook and Twitter. The worry we have is that humanity is being drained out of a lot of young people, especially by these devilish little machines, so that we no longer interact in meaningful ways with others. Is this a big problem that we need to be concerned about, or is it actually making people better to have these machines, kind of?
It can be both. It can be a problem. It can be an epidemic. It can be part of the transition. As you know, technology is a way to connect to the rest of the world quite easily, quite simply. It broadens your horizons. It brings you into circles that otherwise would maybe not be so feasible. Therefore, there is a benefit to technology. The idea is to learn to associate with it in such a way that, let's say, you're not necessarily losing your inner power to it. It is a tool.
Right.
It is a guidance system to like-minded individuals. For many of you, this is where you find your connections. This is where you network. This is where you meet one another. Yet there is a certain amount of caution that goes along with the use of technology. It is not necessarily used by all of you with the same intent. Therefore, it is imperative to develop a relationship with technology, just as you would develop a relationship with another human being, with a non-physical being, with a spirit, with a, you name it. It's a relationship that needs to be nurtured. It's a relationship that needs to grow and move forward in a direction where you're working in conjunction with one another, not combating with one another. When it becomes an inner struggle, a turmoil, you will experience this. You will see this in others. You will see the idea of anger, you'll see the idea of frustration, irritability. This is a sign that that particular episode of being connected to that particular piece of technology may not have been in the best interest of the individual. Children in particular need to become aware of their relationship with technology. They need to interface with it in a way that is healthy, that in a way is safe for them, and in a way that is also empowering. Technology can be very empowering.
Yeah. Yeah.
The drama that you are experiencing and see and feel and hear about through internet channels is a representation,
right,
again, of the state of the collective union. The inner turmoil,
right,
the inner conflict, the inner imbalances being represented through technology that represents the entire globe. Therefore, it is a tool to be in tune and touch with that which is going on around your world, not necessarily just in your community, if that's what you would like to explore.
Right. Do we have time for one more question? Because I do have one more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, all right. A lot of American customs and institutions no longer function like they used to, and badly need to be overhauled. Education, banking and finance, food and nutrition, of course, government, federal, state, and local. The list goes on. If I were a young person today, which I'm not, I'm in my early 60s, if I were a young person today, what kinds of things could I do aside from volunteering, charity work, and so forth to help the whole situation? Or are there any institutions in particular, any areas in particular, that need to be looked at or transformed sooner rather than later?
Well, we feel as though all of them need to be transformed and are transforming sooner than later. In regards to young people, they are, many of them, not all, but many of them, that are entering into your time and space reality currently, are light years ahead than many of you in your age group. The reason being is that they are bringing with them the idea of the new energy, a pure form of the new energy, infusing the planet with it. But as we have spoken about many times, they tend to get lost. They tend to feel disconnected because there is a disconnection between the type of energy that they are bringing with them and the type of energy that they are mixing with when once they arrive.
Yeah, that's pretty much the questions I had, unless you can get you to specify. Okay, one more thing. Your own channeler actually expressed this once in her interview tapes. Cell phones, but back to cell phones. Are they harmful to the brain? Or like my generation or people before my generation ignored the harmful effects of cigarettes and everyone died of lung cancer. Are like cell phones, like the new cigarettes, are like we all going to get brain tumors 20 years from now or something?
We'll take this question in a two-step process. The fundamental idea behind becoming sick or ill is more of a representation of your fear of becoming sick or ill. Many that require an illness of some kind have acquired that illness based on an inner turmoil, based on the idea of fear, a fear-based emotion. Their parents died of lung cancer. Their grandfather died of lung cancer. Their grandfather died of heart disease. Therefore, chances are greater that I too will have heart disease. MS has always been described as a disease that skips a generation. This is a fear-based idea that is passed on from generation to generation to generation to generation to generation. The idea to begin to pass on is that you do not necessarily need to be a slave to the idea of your DNA, of your genetic makeup.
Right.
Therefore, we prefer to talk less about the possibility of cell phones being detrimental to the neurotransmitters, let's say, in the brain, and focus more on the idea of if you feel as though there's a potential that this thing in my hand might be harmful to my brain, then perhaps talk with it farther away from your brain. Follow the intuitive feeling that you're receiving in that moment that will then lead you to the next step. We can't be here to guide you every step of the way. We can be here to remind you of your power within that is telling you which direction would be best suited. But understanding your emotions to such a degree that you can determine whether or not the move you are making is based from the idea of fear, or is it based from the idea of a feeling that is directly connected to your higher self, that is directly connected to source creation, that is directly connected to the collective intelligence that is governing. That is the feeling to go by. That is your guidance system. That will always lead you in the right direction. No failure.
Gotcha.
So based on the principle of what you are discussing, the idea of the cell phone in particular, the principle being that which you are afraid of, that which you put energy into, that which you align with from a vibrational level, is that what you are, that is what you are making the strongest connection with. Therefore, you will eventually begin to see it manifest in a physical form, because you have created the synapse that is required to bring something into fruition, to take it from the idea of a thought and idea and the idea of a potential. And with
right.
the
right.
with the repetition of that fear, or the repetition of that which you feel would be beneficial to bring into your life, it is through the repetition of that eventually leads to the manifestation of it in a physical form, because you are rebuilding the connections that are required to do that. Does this make sense?
Okay. I think my questions are done.
Is that helpful?
I believe you're real precisely because you mentioned no specifics, but it's all a process. So I really appreciate your answers.
We appreciate your questions. We encourage questions. We encourage personal stories. We encourage experiences, because there is a, let's say, uniqueness, yet at the same time, a collaboration amongst all of your stories. There are only so many things that you decided to come here to learn, to move towards, to experience. By experiencing through others, there's a tendency to experience your experiences from a different, more broad perspective.
Right. Yes, yes. My personal experience will be another interview. There's a vast corpus I could go into with that, but thank you very much for your insight.
Yes. We thank you for this opportunity to share with you from an energetic level, from a loving state of existence. We look forward to these exchanges. We thank you once again for your trust and your sincerity and your honesty, and we encourage you to continue to move forth on your path, on your journey. You have much to share still. This is the beginning of grander things to come. Your light is shining bright.
I certainly hope so. Thank you for the encouragement.
Yes.
Thank you, Solomon. Welcome back, Steph.
Hi.
That was intriguing.
Yes, it certainly was. But what I said before about the fact that it's all process and very little in the way of specifics, that's what convinces me that this isn't a sham, that this Solomon entity is real.
Yeah, sorry.
I got to read your book, Stephanie. I haven't read that yet. I'm gonna read it.
Didn't care before, right? You know, that's what's funny is that when I've done some talks at different expos and stuff, I'll be there all day and not a book will sell, and then I open my mouth for half an hour and then all of a sudden I'm just selling books left, right, and center. And all you have to do is close your eyes. And this is the thing. I firmly believe that, you know, one of the biggest reasons why I like doing this and putting myself out there is because I know that it's within all of us. You don't have to go and smash into a rock wall and, you know, have a crazy experience to do it. Like you said earlier in your interview, close your eyes for a little bit. That's all I did. Sure, I hit a rock wall and that might have, you know, knocked me around a little bit and sent me into a slightly different direction. But I also think it had just as much to do with me having to rest and recover. And that meant sitting in quiet. That meant being bored. That meant that led to me pulling out a book and a pen. And that led me thinking, what am I going to write about? And all of a sudden I'm channeling a message from my mother who died in 1996. Mm-hmm. So for people listening, there is so much information that we all have access to. It's beyond belief. But to find it and to hear it, A, you have to be open to it, and B, you, you have to have a certain amount of trust in yourself that it's there.
Mm-hmm. And the intent. All you really need is, like you say, the belief that you can and the intent to do so, and it'll come.
But you don't even, the funny thing is, you don't necessarily even need the intent.
Well, as so for you, yours was a higher intent set by your higher self, for example, right? So, but for those of us who are here listening to you going, wow, I'd really like to do that, I'd like to tap into that, the intent setting is important. For me particular, I'm an example of that, because I wasn't a channeler until, you know, Steph started writing and stuff, and then she started making me write my own messages. And eventually, you see that.
Yeah, one thing to really appreciate is that, you know, we all have a gift mm-hmm. for prophecy. We just have to find our own way of doing it.
Right.
That's right.
There's one really nonsensical idea out there, which we can talk about some other time, that all these great prophets lived, and this is that golden age fallacy nonsense. All these great prophets lived thousands of years ago. There haven't been any since. That's nonsense.
I know.
Well, I'm sorry to cut this conversation short, guys, but we're out of time for today. So thank you so much for joining us today, David, and thanks to all our listeners out there. Please tune in 2 weeks from today, as we will have with us another amazing medium and channel named Mesa, as we continue to explore the idea of self-empowerment. For those of you who would like to learn more about Stephanie and Solomon, please go to our website at stephanie-banks.com, and please subscribe to our YouTube channel at solomonlive.com. Thank you again, everyone, and have a fantastic week.